Good morning, everyone. As Vance just said, my name is Christopher Shepherd. I am a PhD candidate at the University of Arizona in the Department of Soil, Water, and Environmental Science. And today I'm going to be talking about a humped clay production model that I've been working on with John Pelletier and Craig Rasmussen, both at the U of A also. So when we're talking about clay formation, I really think the first question we have to ask ourselves is, what exactly is it that we're going to choose to focus on? I think most people will agree that clay formation is a highly complex process, but it's also multiple processes embedded together. Whether or not it may be neoformation, chemical weathering, or some sort of translocation within the profile itself. And I think when we're talking about or trying to model clay formation, we need to start thinking about what maybe these processes are that we want to focus on. And hopefully most of you will probably also agree with this statement too, but just as there are lots of processes involved in clay formation, there are a bunch of different approaches that you can also take to model clay formation. So the first, I think, that I kind of split them out into two camps as I think about them. You have reductionist approaches, which more along the lines of like, I need to model every single process, every single component, and split that out and have something for it in my scheme, or more holistic approaches, where you're really just trying to model or represent a net behavior of a system. You're trying to represent that bulk or net result of some bulk processes. And it is this second approach, these holistic approaches, which I'll be talking about today. And I really ask this question, how can we model this bulk behavior or this net end result of clay formation in soils? And I think it is this humped clay production model that we can use to do that. So this is the equation. This is one of only two equations that you will see today. If you're familiar with the geomorphic literature or the original work by Gilbert, you probably will be familiar with this formulation, but it really is a semi-empirical model, meaning that there's some physical behavior represented in this equation, but it's not any one process. It is really just a bulk behavior that we observe. And I'd like to point out that this clay production, this dc over dt, is really a function of the clay content of the soil itself, which is c in this equation. So as I just pointed out, dc over dt is clay production or clay accumulation in the soil, the rate of that. And then in the model, we have a few fitting parameters. So we have p sub c, which is the maximum rate of clay production that might be observed. Alpha, which is a characteristic clay content. And really that's going to describe where we see that hump with regards to the clay content of the soil. And then finally, because we are talking about clay content or clay percentages, you can't have a clay content greater than 100%, or that wouldn't make any sense. So we had to limit how much clay you can actually add to the soil over time. And so that's why we have this 1 minus C, or if it was, or we're talking about percentages, it'd be 100%, so 100 minus C. So this is what the equation actually looks like. So we have clay content here on the x-axis, and then the rate of clay production on the y, so dc over dt. And as I said, it's a humped equation, so you have a rising limb, a lowering limb, and some maximum, which is set at alpha. And behind both sides of this function, we have some physical meaning behind that. So we have, in the rising limb, you have increasing clay production. And so what I think this is that you have clay that's being formed, it might begin to be translocated, and that's really going to begin to clog up the pore space in the soil and generate greater water holding capacity in the soil, which would then facilitate greater chemical weathering, greater clay production. Then you pass this point of alpha, this maximum clay production rate, about 12%, and then you have decreasing rates of clay production. And what I think is happening in the decreasing side is that the pool of weatherable minerals is beginning to decrease. So you just can't really produce any more clay. You've run out of reactants. And also potentially the water availability may become limiting. As you begin to clog more and more pore space, you might actually limit the ability of water to flow freely into the soil profile. Okay, so this is awesome. We have this theoretical understanding, but of course we want to test this model against some real data. And I did this using a CARNA sequence database. So we synthesized together 44 different CARNA sequence studies, which represented about 405 different soil profiles. And they're located from a very wide range of ecosystems, climates, lithologies, and landforms. So it's a very diverse data set, which is exactly what you want. You want to be able to test the model in places where it may not work. So with this data now, we are able to parameterize that equation. So I'm going to start off with telling you from right off the bat that we optimized alpha to about 0.12, or about 12% clay. And that's just gave us the best fit with the model to that Karna sequence database. That's why we chose that alpha value. And we let P sub C vary between each of the Karna sequences. So that maximum rate of clay production is going to be dependent on things like climate or lithology, or maybe even something like soil order. So that's how we went by, that's how we went through parameterizing this model or this approach. Okay. So what evidence is there actually in soils that we see this sort of humped clay production? So this is the depth-weighted clay content from that Karna sequence database, and then these are the measured clay production rates. And these different lines are going to be different values of P sub C, that maximum clay production rate. And as you can see, there is some, you know, it goes up, and then it goes back down. As we zoom in a little bit into the data, we can see that there are some very low clay content values that have very high rates of clay production that then begin to level off and decrease as you increase the clay content of the soil. And I think you can see this even better when we put this into log-log space. So now we have the log of this depth-weighted clay content versus the log of the measured clay production rate. And I think, as you can see, at very low rates of clay production, or very low rates of very low clay contents, excuse me, the clay production increases to some peak value, probably about like here, and then it falls off again as you begin to add even more and more and more clay to that soil profile. So it is, we are observing a humped shape in these data. So we have P sub C, that maximum production rate, which we allow to vary across the Karna sequences. And we were able to relate that back to some environmental variables. So as Oesta just pointed, just talked about for a good amount of time, EEMT, or effective energy and mass transfer. We're probably all pretty familiar with that, but it's just the amount of energy fluxing into the solar system due to precipitation and net primary productivity. And as our EEMT increases, or you get to a warmer, more productive climate and ecosystem, the maximum rate of clay production also increases, that fitting parameter, that P sub C. So, you know, it's not great, but it works. So, you know, R squared of 0.2. But I think that also makes sense. This may not be as intuitive. So this is the minimum sequence age. And by that I mean it's the youngest soil in each of those Karna sequence studies, or each of those Karna sequences. And we saw a negative relationship with that maximum clay production rate. And what this really is indicating is if you're out in the field measuring a Karna sequence, and you're already starting your Karna sequence at, say, you know, 100,000 years, you've already missed 100,000 years of clay production. So the model's going to say, oh, it's already pretty low there, and it's going to fit a lower maximum value to that Karna sequence. So that's something that we need to take into account when we're trying to actually parameterize this model. And finally, when looking at the dominant lithology of each of the Karna sequences, we see that there are systematic differences. We see highest maximum production rates in the sedimentary rock type, about a moderate amount in the igneous rock type, and then the lowest, we observe the lowest P sub C value in the metamorphic rock type. So really, with these three figures here, we can use these systematic differences we observe between the Karna sequences to predict this P sub C value. So we can actually go out and measure these things, like EEMT or minimum age or the lithology, and have a pretty good idea of what that maximum clay production rate might be. So in the last few minutes of my talk, I'd like to go through a test case. So this is from the Cañada del Oro Karna sequence in southeastern Arizona. If you're familiar with some of the early work of Les McFadden, this is the Karna sequence that he was working on. And it spans about 10 to the 3 to 10 to the 6 years. It formed on mixed granitic alluvium. It probably gets somewhere around 30 centimeters of mean annual precipitation every year. And the mean annual temperature ranges from probably about 25 degrees Celsius to about 18 degrees Celsius. And this is a picture of the oldest site. And what we can do with this equation is that we can use a numerical integration scheme and actually solve for clay content. So we can solve for the clay content across time, and that's what's represented in this figure here. So these are the different soils that we have in the Carnot sequence, and you know, the model does pretty well at predicting the clay evolution over time, except when you get to about 100,000 years, and then the model is going to say, oh, clay content is just going to keep going up and up and up. There's nothing limiting it in this formulation of the model. There's something that's slowing that clay formation down. So what we did was we decided to add erosion into this model. So we altered it very slightly. This is the production term here still. If you look here, same thing, production. Still there, production. But we added an erosive term, this E over H. And what E over H is doing is going to start taking away some of that clay that's being formed just due to erosion. And what we found is that when you do that, and you do that same numerical integration scheme, that this clay evolution over time conforms very closely to what we actually observed with the Kenyatta del Oro chrono sequence. And we were able to do this across all of the different 44 different chrono sequences, and we get just about the same result. The model actually conforms really well with the clay evolution that we see over time. And one thing I'd also like to point out too is that when we do fit this E over H term, this erosive term, in order for the model to work and to actually represent this clay evolution over time, we found that E over H was always consistently across all the Carnot sequences an order of magnitude less than that maximum production rate, that P sub C. And that really is indicating that these landscapes, or at least these Carnot sequences where they're cited, are very finely tuned to their environment. The production of clay and the erosive term, they're in tune with one another. And when something maybe pushes that, say a glacial change or some interglacial glacial cycling, you push that out of that way, you're going to start having some response in that landscape, and you might begin to erode away more clay, or you might begin to even form more clay. And so this very simple approach can give us a lot of power in understanding this sort of net behavior that we see in clay production. So I think I just said probably a lot of these things, but I think this is a potentially very powerful approach. But it is semi-empirical, meaning that it's not necessarily a representation of any one process, but really just the net result of multiple processes. But it is a way that we can understand clay evolution across a very wide range of locations. And something else is that this model, with that erosive term added to it, is very easily incorporated into existing landscape evolution models. So we could take this model, combine it in with some of the existing geomorphic models that we already have, and begin to understand in some systematic way how landscapes and soil landscapes are evolving. Several caveats I'd like to also mention is that the model did not consider the distribution of clay content with depth. That's something that needs to be taken into account. It also in this formulation, I did not include explicit differences really due to parent material. So I think that's something else that I need to go back and revisit and make sure that I'm adding in a more explicit way. So with that, I'd like to thank all of my funding sources, UA Grad Center, Space Grant Consortium, the Catalina Jimenez Critical Zone Observatory, as well as the UA Flandreau Science Center and Planetarium. So thank you for your time and your attention.
Yeah.
I
don't care.
Was there any way you addressed erosion? Was there any way to address deposition for dust?
No, it doesn't. No, we did not address deposition. And in that Carnot sequence, the Kenyatta del Oro Carnot sequence, dust would have been a major impact. If you saw Rebecca Librand's talk yesterday morning or yesterday afternoon, she actually talked extensively about dust inputs in semi-arid landscapes in southeastern Arizona. So that is something that locally, in some places, may be very important. Yes?
How does your model distinguish a true alluvial clay from clay that has formed in situ due to the disintegration of mica, for example?
It doesn't take that into account. It doesn't take into account like specific mineral transformations or things that might have just been added due to alluvium. So say you have like some pulse of sediment off of a landscape added to and deposited. One way that we can do that, though, is if we can go backwards.
in this numerical integration scheme, you have to set a C naught. You have to set a starting clay content. So that might be some way in which we can distinguish what clay content is inherited from that alluvium versus what clay content might actually be due to that neoformation we see from, say, dissolution of mica.
Well, that doesn't really get to the point that I was making.
Okay.
Without knowing a lot about your data set, it's not clear to me that if you have great differences in the quantity of clay that's produced in situ due to the disintegration of mica, mm-hmm. I've got to believe that's going to affect your results.
Yeah, I mean, that's something that the model doesn't necessarily take into account. Differences due to the mineral transformations at any given location versus something that might have been inherited from the initial parent material. So, yeah.